it's to kind of think about this subversive opportunism in this case of public space. I think it's the subversion could be in complexifying the civic process. What goes on? So I mean, like the kind of the answer to that that would be that all should be involved, you know, instead of purifying the protest.
Does anybody have questions to the other
speakers?
Well,
you can
now.
Okay.
Sweden. I'm coming back to the beginning. What was the thing about you saying that that somehow the space programmed the condition of riots, or was it about Manila? The riots started because of the spatial condition, or
no.
attempts to change it by neoliberal.
I think it has more to do with. An outspoken idea from 1952, as it was in the comprehensive plan up until 2010, was that city planning also had a social responsibility to diminish the negative impacts of market economy. So trying to that socially homogenized areas that are divided through economy was a bad thing for society as a whole. So there should be a mix. So all these kind of housing areas and so on, it's always a mix of rental, different sizes, and often in traditional modernist schemes, the population was understood as the same, like the same. You built three-room apartments for the working class, and just next to that, row houses for the lower middle class, and detached villas from the for the not the upper class maybe, but the upper middle class. So these kind of areas are connected, and that was a governing rule. But the important tool there was that rents were controlled by the city. Even for private developers, were not free to set whatever rents they wanted. It was not on a free market. And the own homer associations that came not from political initiatives originally in Sweden, but from large social movements that drove on towards a more just and city with higher standards of living and so on. So it meant that you joined a cooperative that was also a bank, you saved money. After a certain period, because of the money put in by all these members, was then made into apartments that you, with your savings, then had the option to buy when it was ready. So I live in such an area now. But from 1968 until 1993, that was a long process of deregulating this market. But my flat, for instance, up until 1993, you could sell it, but you could not sell it to any price you want. But the price was connected to the rental market. So it went through a commission in the city, so you can sell it for this much money. And that was connected to yourself. So exactly what you're saying, a very kind of controlled way. And that was a way to create the idea of apartment as a social right, and that you're building society. And then now we have something, a complete market instead. Yeah, exactly. And what has happened, of course, is in such a condition, the neighborhoods that has the worst reputation, that is understood as being least valuable, that has the highest number of immigrants, the higher numbers of people on social welfare, unemployed and so on, they are gathered in one area. And then on top of that, there is a slashing of public funding into libraries, schools, all of this. We have a school reform when it's... which is free, that has also impacted the quality of education. So a lot of people are, both that they are not, in this area, there's like 75% has a non-Swedish background. So it's ethnically extremely segregated, Stockholm, economically extremely segregated. But this has happened over two decades. So when these things explode, then everyone is, oh, it's, you know, there's the same logic, it's criminal behavior. Yeah. And there were people who tried to speak up, that local social organizations that are working with homework for kids, you know, all sorts of voluntary work. When they speak up and say that this is the product of a politics that has been going on for 2 decades, then they are branded as, because so you are for violence. That's what the journalists say. I said, not necessarily, but you have to see that there is a cause and effect. But do you say no to violence? And then, I mean, they are in a...
This is really like...
So they're pushed in a corner, and now they are like, okay, you are like a terrorist, not terrorist, but hooligans, you know. So it's a very... And this is very... this, I would say, is the reason. So it's not a space... I mean... From a market point of view, it has very low value. But I've been doing projects and been working in a lot of these areas, and they were not built as social housing, ever. It was not built for the poor. It was built for the majority of the Swedish population. It was 1 million apartments. That was something like 35% of the total population would change housing in 10 years. So it's a massive, you know, yeah. And it was an upgrade. It was a modernization of the city.
This is like a classic strategy which you can see in both America and also in Britain, which is that in order to deconstruct the welfare state, you have to make the welfare state not look like it's for the people. If the welfare state, if you say who is this national healthcare system for, and someone says it's for everyone, then you can't say, well, let's sell it. It's like, well, no, that's terrible. But if you say the national healthcare system is only being used for people who are unemployed and criminals, then the middle class say, well, I don't see why I should pay for that. Let's sell it. And so you use this, and actually the relationship with social housing is also very important. I mean, I think there's a very good argument that the Pruitt-Igoe, which is, you know, this kind of classic failure of modernism, right? But actually it's a very strategic failure of modernism, because if the social housing succeeds, what happens to the private property market? I mean, how are you going to make a profit from housing people and speculating on property if there's an oversupply of housing in the market? So they go together. First you stigmatize the social housing in order to make sure that there's no public housing that's made. And at the same time, you manage to do that by saying, well, look, we're building all this housing for these poor people, and then look at them, they're just criminals. So we're not going to build anymore, and we're going to deconstruct the welfare state as a result. It's beautiful the way it all just, it's like these massive cogs, and they just all interlock.
But does such forum exist where such decision takes place and stigmatize this and edit that?
I believe that it's a series of cumulative accidents by people who have a general idea of what it is they want to do. Because sometimes you see these, you think it could be just a bunch of accidents. It's just a little bit of legislation here, a little bit there. But then every now and again, you can see very slight moments where the system shows itself for what it is. And you can see that people know what they're doing. I mean, one of these in Britain is the moment at which they decide to sell all of the social housing stock, because the idea is that everyone is going to own their own home. Everyone is going to be you know, have an investment in their own property. But what Thatcher says is that the proceeds from sales of social housing cannot be used to make more social housing. And it's that one small piece of law which basically says we're going to sell all of our social housing, but we're not going to build any more. That's the moment, because the logic would normally be, okay, everyone should have their own house, so we're going to build a house for everyone. You know, so it's in those moments when you see that slight law change that... and you know, that money that was used from the sale of social housing was used to stimulate economic growth, which led to enormous competition between cities, which is why you also end up with like city branding, basically, because there's enormous competition for resources between different regions. So you know, it all feeds into itself, and I don't think it's benign. I think it's sinister.
So you are for some kind of automatism that you basically program through spatial organization the way things land on the ground, the way things take shape. That's your kind of proposal.
Yeah, I mean, I'm not really sure, to be honest.
One example of all this is in Spain, in Madrid. They were 15 years ago very rich in the initiatives for social housing, and under that way of behaving, they start commissioning the buildings for social housing to big names architects like Alejandro Sayarapolo and after that they build the complex of social housing with different names behind the buildings. People were living there, and 5 years after that they started selling the houses. Mm. And they knew before that having a big name behind the building will increase the value. So it was something that they say no, of course, but everybody knows that it was planned since the first moment, because why to hire a super expensive architect to build social housing? So it was like...
Clever,
yeah.
So design has value.
That's
the good
news, no? Yeah. I don't know about that. I mean,
but the name, see? The name. You know, it's like dating a home. It's all exchange value. Yeah, it's fucking, it's shit art. It's like amongst the worst art that's ever been made. And yet, you know, it circulates for more than anyone else because people have agreed on it. I mean, there's this very interesting policy. The banks in London have what they call swag vaults, which is silver, wine, art, and gold. And they have like reserves. In addition to their like intangible currency, which are these ones and zeros, they have to have a certain portion in other forms of investment. And so they invest in silver, wine, art, and gold. And the only reason that the art is worth anything is because all the banks agree that that's what it's going to be worth. And there are artists that you've never heard of that circulate for millions of dollars between banks, constantly being shifted back and forth between corporations. And this is the kind of generation of value which I think is amazing. It's also true for architects. It's like, is a Rem Koolhaas building better than a local architect? No way. But the exchange value of Rem Koolhaas is enormous.
How does that happen? It's a mystery. How I can't has cheeseburgers? That's the question.
But coming back, I was thinking of what we talked about with the attention economy a little bit. You are familiar with this concept somehow. It came.
What is it called?
The attention economy. It was a book by the Harvard Business School that was done in 2001 by Davenport and Beck, and it's an idea of attention economics. It's a management of information, and it treats human attention as a scarce commodity. And then I'm reading now, and it applies economic theory to solve various information management problems somehow. So it's this that.
That's before Facebook.
Yeah, exactly.
And actually, the idea from the 90s, from this guy Marcus Gold,
Yes, it is actually yes, but and there's several. But it is interesting somehow because we are the scarce commodity, like our attention is what is the value in the future. It's the currency somehow, what we pay attention to, and there you can see, for instance, there is the same time when Nike stops making shoes. They have not produced shoes for, I think, 2 decades almost. They only lease the opportunity for different companies to make shoes to put the brand on. So the only thing they own is the brand. So they can tell you, and they only work on their on their swoosh. That's their product somehow, because everything else is connected to risk. And there is a line of factories that want to produce these shoes, but they take all the risk. Somehow, so it's always managing this brand. So the shoes are secondary somehow, and this is difficult to grasp because it's so it's logical in an attention economy world, but not in another. And I would say this translates very well to how we see now the city somehow, because when we speak about, I mean, what is this notion of public space for whom somehow, and it's a segmented market, so it's a certain publicness somehow is developed for target groups that have certain values and can be connected to. And that becomes very obvious when you start to behave in a certain, slightly different manner. So this openness that your Arulat talked about in New York. I was there doing a project a couple of years ago where we were, for it's a weird project, but we re-shot the entire movie of On the Town with Gene Kelly and Fred Astaire from 52, when it's like a musical, they dance around in New York. So we did that, shot by shot, over a month, and then we showed this amateur movie we made without actors, and only the city in the foreground. So we found all these locations. And one was on top of the Empire State Building. And Fred Astaire is there singing to his love interest in the movie. And they're dancing around. So we were filming. Everyone up there is filming. Like hundreds of people standing filming. But we were the only ones who were filming in the wrong directions. Like Fred Astaire is coming this way, you know. And it took like 10 minutes before some guards showed up and said, "What are you doing?" And filming. Like everyone else, but and then they didn't believe us, so they called in Homeland Security, and then we ended up in interrogated, and they started to look through our video camera, and we only had like strange footage of monuments all over New York with no selfies or anything. So it was a mess, and it's an art project, but like it felt, the more you speak, the less hollow it becomes. But it was interesting. And then we found out that it's forbidden to film in public space in New York. I mean, they allow it, but it's also forbidden somehow. So we were breaking the
permission.
Yeah, exactly, a permission. And that was extremely expensive.
Yeah,
so there is an interesting, that as just something that you feel is a very small divergence from what you're doing, suddenly it comes crashing down and you are like interrogating for 12 hours. And this is really fascinating, because of course if that happens with a white middle class Swedish guy, then you can only imagine how this plays out for other kind of people. So this accessibility and publicness is very important to see that it's not, when it's talked about from architects and planners and so on, it's well-behaving consumers that behave.
I want to bring other concept of conversation, because it's after the attention economy, there is reputation economy, that it emerged in the, you know, with the sharing economy trend. For example, Airbnb, if you have more likes or more ratings, you can ask for more money for your flat. So it's a reputation economy. And I think it's very linked to the cities also, because having this kind of public spaces, even if we consider they are not so public, increase your reputation for city branding, as Jacques mentioned. So there is a competition about reputation economy also, because it has effects in the normal traditional economy. So it's a concept that is very used nowadays in this kind of urban development.
I mean, what's underpinning it is the idea of the city as a financial project. The city itself as a generator of value. You know, the reason you can't film certain buildings in Britain has nothing to do with security. It has to do with the fact that if you didn't publish that picture in a book, you own the copyright. And, you know, it can't be possible that you're able to generate profit from someone else's building. So, you know, these are underlying problems of who controls the value generation inside the urban realm.
It's also, I had this idea. Today is 25 years of Baltic Way. I think it's a kind of attention economy. It's interesting that it was, for those who don't know, it was a human chain connecting talent to humans all over the highway, around like around 2 million people kind of were mobilized to participate. You know? But I think the way that is possible, the way that all these societies have the same kind of condition. Same condition of housing, the same condition of some kind of defined by classes and so on. So just one everyday kind of life, which basically through that it was possible to organize this action, which I think in Istanbul the same happens through. common condition. So in a way, this kind of diversification through kind of the attention economy or as you said, the
reputation,
the you create these kind of pockets of highs and lows, which basically kind of make society completely detached from one another. I think it's in order to dismantle the kind of Soviet Union was through basically the kind of banal everyday condition was really possible. I think that's kind of the idea when kind of social movement becomes the scale of industry or paradigm.
Yeah, I mean, you think of this image of Foucault from Discipline and Punishment, of the criminals being re-educated, each in their own box, looking only forward. The possibility of talking to your neighbor is already a subversive act. I mean, this is why under Fordist production, there was silence in the factories, because all forms of talk were subversive to production. And so, as part of this, we were talking about feeling lonely, or the case of being alone, being increasingly kind of a condition of our time. You must be lonely, or else they can't exploit you. It's, you might confer with someone else. And this is also, in many companies, it's now illegal to, or it's against the terms of your contract, to tell another employee how much you make, because that way they can employ every individual on a different sum. Whereas previously, if you look at gaps in wages between ages as well, if you go back to the 1960s, if you went into a factory at 19 or you were there at 40, you earned the same amount of money. And that meant that at 19 you could have a family, you could maybe buy a car, you could have the same standard of life as someone who was much older. Whereas now it's because of this process of constantly separating up each individual on an individual contract, you get what is effectively a grade where you become underemployed and lowly employed for decades. And that exploitation is very much based on the idea that you cannot communicate and you have nothing in common with the next person.
Mm-hmm. That's also interesting, the way that the focus changes from a mass that could at best produce products that they couldn't probably even buy themselves. But now everyone is an individual, and that normality does also get like blurred. You can be as anything you like. It's even better that you produce your identity, because with that comes a lot more opportunities to sell things for it, and for you to sell, and for you to loan money to buy your new identity. So this mute factory worker was in fact very inefficient for capital.
It
was just the only way they knew how to treat it before. So that, and that's also make this, I mean, the resistance of older days, of course, much more easy, because it would just mean that I talk to you and we had a revolution of sorts.
Yeah.
Now I talk to you and somebody will make money out of that. It's a very, on the one hand, on a positive side, it's like, for instance, normality is hard to grasp, but it's what average is normal, and that can change, and I think that's a good thing that has come with this. But on the other hand, it's also very difficult to see where to resist. And still, we can see that in Sweden, very much so, and I guess all over the world, that the gap between the richest and the poorest is wider now than ever. So it's not like this redistributing of normality and everything has meant equality. So that's also, kind of interesting.
Yeah.
And that we, for some reason, are satisfied with that. The question is, of course, how would a resistance look today? And what we can see is that we can see these pockets of where they have, a revolution social in the country, or where you find another school building, or we have a crisis of sort that we can manifest and we can do something about it, and perhaps in the long term. But is that at all, or can there be tools for reshaping society in a way that this becomes more equal? Mm. Or is that, I mean, like, mm. so Lost Friday, nobody cares about it anymore. And what would that mean? I mean, because we also say, I mean, I totally agree with that, like, the attention with the Damien Hirst gains, at least economic-wise, mm. also otherwise, mm. has no relevance in his art. Mm. But just because something is overrated, it doesn't mean that it has no value. And Damien Hirst perhaps not a good example, but I mean, there must be ways to find values mm. or mm. addressing space mm. Mm. in a way that actually has a productive mm. way out of this.
Mm.
So that's my question to you guys.
Oh,
what's
the way to do? I'm sorry, I have to break it off. Mm. Oh,
that's
cool. But then we have to give big thanks to Nessa for us today.
Thank you.
And then we can continue.
Pretty hard. It's not enough to be here anymore.
Yep,
thank you.
Thank you.